Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we're celebrating Mardi Gras. I'll be talking with Howard Philip Smith, author of the gorgeous new book, Unveiling the Muse, The Lost History of Gay Carnival in New Orleans. And we'll hear from Al Kennedy, whose new book is Chief of Chiefs, Robert Nathaniel Lee and the Mardi Gras Indians of New Orleans, 1915 to 2001. Howard Philip Smith is the art director for the libraries at the University of Southern California. But before Los Angeles pulled him away, he lived in New Orleans, once as a toddler, where he had his first glimpse of a Mardi Gras parade, and again for a decade in the 80s. His love of the Crescent City and its well-known celebration are the inspiration for a fabulous new book, and I do mean fabulous, titled Unveiling the Muse, The Lost History of Gay Carnival in New Orleans. Howard Philip Smith, welcome to The Reading Life.
Good to be here.
This book is one of the most gorgeous books I have ever seen. And your background in art and photography really shines through on every page. So talk about the beginning. Talk about how you came to put this book together.
The book, as I originally envisioned it, was not what you have today. It was really was going to be a work of historical fiction. I wanted to recreate my time in New Orleans because it was so interesting. There were so many interesting characters, and it was a very gay subculture at that time. We had our own world, and it was just fantastic. And then in the mid-80s, I moved to Los Angeles, and I kept thinking, well, I want to recreate that in some way. And I started this novel, but I wanted the backdrop to be Gay Carnival. So I thought, oh, well, I'll do some research. I'll see what I can find. There wasn't really a lot published on Gay Carnival. So I started delving into the archives. I started trying to contact people that I knew, and a lot of them were gone because they had died during the AIDS crisis. And then I got this chance to write a few articles for Arthur Hardy. The novel was finished. Nobody wanted to publish it. It's still waiting, by the way. But Arthur Hardy had a few slots that he wanted to fill, and he contacted me. And so I was able to do a series of articles on the history of Gay Carnival on different crews. Mm-hmm. And I think one article I did on artists of Gay Carnival. So I thought, well, I have all of these articles. I'm halfway there to a real history book. Little did I know, this was about 4 or 5 years ago when I approached University Press of Mississippi, Craig Gill. He said, yeah, we're really interested in it. What can you finish up on this? So, it took a while to get the full manuscript together. And then I kept discovering wonderful artworks. It's almost like each item in this book has a backstory, an incredible backstory. When we put it all together, they said, we want a large format book to showcase this artwork. We want it to be just an incredible book. So they were behind it all the way.
And it is. But it's much more than this gorgeous coffee table book. It is really a scholarly work of history. You have assembled so much information here. You track down every gay crew you could find. You track down all the monarchs. You track down the parade themes and all this ephemera. And that's something Henri Schindler, who wrote the foreword to this book, has always said, that New Orleans is a climate not kind to paper and velvet. And so much of this carnival history is fragile.
Well, I'm really surprised myself at how much I've been able to find. There were a couple of guys in the gay crews who, they were pack rats, let's just put it straight. I interviewed a couple of them, and they collected everything. They said, we were so excited to go to these balls and participate. This was our world. And they just saved everything. And then they decided to donate to various collections in town. So right there, I was off to a good start. Historic New Orleans collection, Tulane, the State Museum, all these places had bits and pieces. The public library, UNO here, has some stuff. I think people just hid this stuff in their closets for years. Uh-huh. And then once I contacted them, once I could talk to them about this project, they would start pulling stuff out. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that stuff is now in collections.
Well, you were worried that this history was fading and was being lost. And, you know, if you didn't do something relatively quickly and substantially, it would
yes.
be gone. And part of the reason it was fading was because of the AIDS epidemic. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
By the late 80s, early 90s, many of the crews were gone because of the AIDS crisis. A mm-hmm. lot of the guys in the crews were just passed away from the epidemic, and Gay Carnival almost disappeared, quite honestly. A few of the crews kept going, and they've come back strong. But there's an interesting story about a couple of guys who were in the original crew, the first crew of Yuga. Mm-hmm. Now, they're gone. I was able to interview a couple of these guys many years ago, 10, 15 years ago, and they were able to tell me about these really early balls. And, of course, the police raid for the fifth Yuga ball, which that was the end of the crew of Yuga.
And we should say they began in 1958.
1958.
Quite a while.
And that was a hard time for the gay community because the police were really ramping up this harassment of deviants is what they actually called it. The DA called it that. So my point is, I think if you started writing this history today, you would not have access to these people. They're gone. Mm-hmm. So the really the earliest voices that we have from the 50s, from the first crew, they're gone. Everybody's gone.
Oh, I know. So sad. And there are such great characters in this book. I mean, so many of them deserve whole novels or biographies of their own.
Hey, I'm working on
all right.
That's why
yeah.
That's what kept me going with this book over two decades. It's over two decades. But that just kept uncovering these really incredibly interesting characters.
So let's talk about Elmo Ave for one. He's an interesting character.
He's a good one. Elmo Ave is really one of the most interesting characters in this whole history, and he really helped to shape the early gay crews, in fact. Now, Henri Schindler, in his book, Mardi Gras New Orleans, he has a few photographs of Henri dressed in these outlandish costumes. One in particular, he's a captured mermaid. There's this sailor that's attached, a mannequin of a sailor that's attached to the back of him, and his fin is coming out in the front. And this just shows you the creativity of Elmo Ave. Now, he was born in a small town, Plaquemine. And then he came to New Orleans and fell in love with it. But then he went to Los Angeles. Now, he stayed out in Los Angeles and worked for the studios, the film studios, for decades. Then he jumped to Manhattan in the 40s, where he had an antique business. And he met Patrick Dennis, who wrote Anti-Mame. So he was involved with this very creative group in Manhattan. And then he ended up back in New Orleans with his antique shop. And he bought a house on Bourbon Street. He had a lot of real estate, actually. He had a house on Decatur, and then he had his Royal Street antique store. Now, he held court at Miss Dixie's Bar, Dixie's Bar of Music, Yvonne Froschnacht and her sister Irma. And he was just very visible in this art community that really formed in the early 50s. There's a great point in my research when I discovered this treasure trove of photographs from the early 50s. And it shows gay men in costume just being very gay in the streets of the French Quarter. And I knew that this had to be part of this creation of the gay carnival crews. Mm-hmm. And that's what my research led me to. Elmo, with his knowledge of sets and costumes from MGM, he led the way. And so they had costume parties, and it just segued into this camp royalty, you know, presenting the queen, which is a gay man in drag, at these gay balls. Fabulous.
It was inevitable.
It really was. It really was. I think that's true. It just was a natural progression.
You talk about Miss Dixie's and that treasure trove of photographs. And one of my favorites is that one of Clay Shaw dressed as Socrates on the street. It's fabulous.
That was another puzzle piece because I've heard many stories about Clay Shaw. Everybody knows he was gay. Everybody knows that Jim Garrison had it in for him. There's so many good legends, so many good myths about those two to begin with. But then why did he prosecute him so much? That's a long story. But he was involved with this art group, the gay costume party carnival crews. You know, he went to these functions and just had a blast.
And Tennessee Williams, of course, makes a cameo appearance, which I loved very much. So talk about that.
Well, you can't really talk about New Orleans gay history without talking about Tennessee Williams. Come on. he's just another puzzle piece. A few years ago, his notebooks finally came out. And it's a book, you know,
huge.
3 inches, you know, thick. And I went through that whole thing page by page. And he talks about his experience coming to New Orleans for the first time in 38. I mean, these notebooks are his intimate diaries, if you ask me. Mm-hmm. And he just landed here and he just went, oh, my God, this is just like some kind of movie set here. It's just so much fun. And he went to the gay bars and just went crazy because he had found a place where he felt open. He could be open and just have fun. And of course, he wrote a lot of his plays based on characters here in New Orleans. When he was in town, he would go to some of the gay balls.
Mm-hmm. And he went to one, and the theme was the Bluebird of Happiness.
This is a really good story. People ask me, how do you know he went to this ball? Well,
yes, how do you know?
Well, confession time. This was the first ball that I went to.
Oh,
when
wow.
I was a young man in my 20s, yes, first ball. And, of course, this was out in Chalmette at the St. Bernard Civic Center. And after the ball, they would clear away the tables and the music would start up. This was after all the royalty had been presented, you know, from the other gay crews. They call them up and introduce them. Even the reigning queen will have her mother and sister come up. It's very touching. But anyway, they cleared all the tables and people started dancing and we're all kind of standing around talking. It's just a big mash of people out in front of the stage. And someone grabbed me, Howard, come meet Tennessee Williams. And we were both kind of loaded. So we just grabbed each other and started dancing. So I've danced with Tennessee Williams. That's how I know he was at the ball.
That is the best story of all.
But you know, I lived some of this history. I went to the great balls in the 80s, and that really is what stuck in my mind.
Speaking from a purely selfish point of view, you know, you look through this book and you imagine what might have been. And I look at it and I think, oh, I would have loved to have gone to the Barbara Ball. That was hilarious. All the Barbaras and
they
Barbies.
They come up with it, I tell you.
It was genius. And then the Space Oddity Ball, inspired by David Bowie, of course. So what ball have you not seen that you would have liked to have seen?
Well, there's my favorite ball, and it's the glorification of the American girl. And this is kind of loosely based on a movie in the 30s called Glorifying the American Girl. It's a black and white movie, but then they have a color fashion show. And this is a movie that Elmo worked on. So he brought this kind of flavor for this movie. This was in 1969 for the ball. And it's just these very outlandish costumes. Supposedly it was Ziegfeld Follies, but the stage opens up and you have all these girls in pink tights with these huge pink fans and they're all fluttering around like the Follies. And then they come together and make this kind of screen and all of the costumes come out through these feathers.
Oh, wow.
And this was Elmo's last ball. His costume was a tribute to the flower children.
Oh.
And he was just covered in live flowers. And he was supposed to be the queen the next year, but he died in December. So he was not the queen like he was supposed
sad.
To be. But just really, really creative, artistic costumes. Oh, the queen came out as Marie Antoinette with her bosom kind of exposed. It was hilarious.
Well, there are lots.
That was a good one.
There are lots of great costume ideas in this book, I will say.
Well, you know, feel free.
Very useful. Very
feel
useful.
Feel free. You need a new costume.
Don't we all? Every year we need a new suit. So tell me, what does Gay Carnival mean to the rest of the country? What can this book do for someone who has never seen Gay Carnival, doesn't know New Orleans? What is this contribution overall to gay culture?
I think that's the question that should remain with everyone after this book. I think the whole nation is interested in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. It's such a treasure for the country. The culture is so unique here. Everything is just different here, and people love coming here, letting their hair down, experiencing Mardi Gras, there's no doubt about it. But what's been missing is that the gay carnival part of it has been hidden all of these years, forcibly, you know, during most of the history. But recently, it's more visible. But there's just no history about it. Now with this book, I feel very certain with this. Now that we have a real history for gay carnival, it just becomes part of the carnival history. So when you talk about the carnival history of New Orleans and the rest of the country, you have to talk about the Zulus. You have to talk about Endymion. You have to talk about the Old Line. You have to talk about gay carnival.
Amen. Amen.
Amen. We have it.
What a contribution you've made. You should be really proud.
Well, I'm exhausted. I have to tell you.
Well, if you had seen me open this book and squeal with delight, I think it might have been worth it.
It's a hefty one.
It is a happy, hefty book, I must say. We've been talking with Howard Phillips Smith, who is the author of Unveiling the Muse, The Lost History of Gay Carnival in New Orleans. Howard, thank you so much, and happy Mardi Gras to you.
Thank you, Susan. Happy Mardi Gras.
It's a great pleasure to welcome historian Al Kennedy to The Reading Life. He's the author of Core Changes on the Chalkboard, How Public School Teachers Shaped Jazz and the Music of New Orleans, and Big Chief Harrison and the Mardi Gras Indians. Today we're talking about his new book, Chief of Chiefs, Robert Nathaniel Lee and the Mardi Gras Indians of New Orleans, 1915 to 2001. Al Kennedy, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I love being here.
What a book, and what a life, a long, good life.
It's so many things in life happen by accident, and it was an accident that I was asked to do Big Chief Harrison. Then it was an accident and serendipity for me that Mr. Harrison invited Big Chief Robbie to sit in.
Wasn't it like a blessing? You know, a blessing for like, okay, you've done this book, now go do the next book.
Well, I didn't know I was going to do it, and so I put away Big Chief Harrison, and then there's that point when you suddenly keep remembering and you see people who look like him and you hear expressions and all of a sudden you remember there's some work that needs to be done. And it was writing, it was putting this life story on paper.
So how did you first get interested in writing about the Mardi Gras Indians?
Accident. It came,
happy accident.
It came from doing my first book, Core Changes, and I met Cherise Harrison over at Haley School. She was bringing in all these incredible resources from the community, jazz musicians, Mardi Gras Indians, others. And then in 1997, on a cold month, she called me and asked me if I might consider interviewing her father. And I let things slide for a bit. And then at the jazz festival that year in 98, Mrs. Harrison caught me and asked me if I would consider doing, you know, interviewing her husband. So between the two of them and their gentle persuasion, I said, sure.
Now, one of the people you talk about in this book who's so interesting is the big chief of the Creole Wild West, and that's Brother Tillman, who also seemed like he could take a book of his own, you know? He could hold that story.
There are so many of these individuals that were incredible leaders, community leaders in every possible way, artists and men of courage. So yes, he could. Brother Tillman was the man who inspired Big Chief Robbie from the time he was a child.
So tell us about Big Chief Robbie's life. He lived so long. He saw so much change and he did so much in his life. So talk a little bit about the arc of that life and what you learned from getting to know him.
A child who at the age of 7, he saw the ending result of an incident that had taken place blocks away, but all he remembered were men in these incredibly artistic outfits who were strong, who everything about them made this 7-year-old think, I want to do that. Then he lost his father at the age of 10 and had to work and worked. And so he would gravitated toward the older men of his neighborhood who were in this masking tradition. And he would sit there with them. He would work himself into their crowds. He would listen. And then he heard about Brother Tillman, and he would take in children. And the kids would gather there, and they would listen to him. He'd teach them songs. And he would teach them, you know, the traditions. He'd teach them how to sew. And they were so excited. Like Robbie said, I felt like a heck of a fellow when Big Chief Tillman finally said, would you sew this for me?
Yeah. But you described some of the early conditions of his life when he and his brothers and sisters, his family, would go to Ponchatoula to pick strawberries and drop out of school to do that work. And those conditions were terrible.
They were terrible. They were the physical conditions and the racial conditions.
Yes.
His mother would take the family out of school. And they would have to, you know, because they needed the money. There was no other means of support. But there, in the racial climate, that, you know, his sister had to get used to getting off the sidewalk when someone white was approaching. There was, a sheriff there who rode a horse who carried a whip. That, all too often, African American children felt that whip. it was a system that was totally geared against them. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he survived several incidents that I describe in the book. But then after that, you had the hard physical labor of working in the brutal sun picking strawberries. The one scene that I mentioned is I went to their house. She was narrating Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. And they both talked about how much that reminded them of the migrant workers and what they had to do when they were little. And it was a tough time, you could tell.
So describe his working life as an adult.
He worked for the WPA projects when he was, you know, a young man, helped dig the lagoons in City Park, helped build Tad Gormley Stadium. He worked for a paint company during World War II. He did odd jobs whenever he could find them. And then he got a job on the docks. And everywhere he went, though, from city working, digging lagoons in City Park to the docks, there was this influence of these men who masked Indian.
Right.
And I talk about in the narrative how working on the labor crews, digging the lagoons, hand-hauling mud and wheelbarrows across to build the greens. And there would be a man who would be leading a group of them and singing some of the Mardi Gras Indian songs mm-hmm. to accompany their work.
So tell me, why was he involved with so many different tribes?
Well, because as he told me, that I never once went, you know, seeking joining a gang. They came to me. Mm-hmm. So that he wanted to be part of Creole Wild West, and he was happy there. And then whenever Brother Tillman got to where he could no longer keep up with what it took to cross the city on Mardi Gras Day, the men asked Robbie to take over. And he didn't want to. He was reluctant because this was his mentor. He was having to tell one of the legends, it's time to step down. But, you know, and then that was when Brother Tillman said, you know, heartbroken, he said, I understand you have to do this, but don't take my, you know, he called him baby boy. He said, baby boy, don't take my name. So he left the Creole Wild West with Brother Tillman, and he went out to another group that had been off the street for a while, asked the old chief. They took that name. Then the chief came back and wanted that group. Then they were without a name again, and they started the White Eagles. Then he moved down to the Ninth Ward, and a group came to him, and he started the Ninth Ward Hunters. And then, you know, came back across and started another one. So, you know, as he said, they always came to me. I never, and that let him say, if we could do it my way, then we can do it.
So he is the chief of chiefs for sure.
Well, the Mardi Gras Indian Council certainly thought so in the 1980s.
Now, did you ever sit with him and talk to him about the works of art that became his suits?
Of course, by then it was, he had lost his eyesight.
I know.
And he could remember. And he remembered so vividly. He remembered years and he remembered colors and he remembered who had what on each year. That's how he, you know, it was like better than a calendar who had wore what each year. Mm-hmm. But he talked about, you know, starting with his beadwork, that there were some people who could freehand draw. They would find them. Then he would buy the very cheap coloring books and trace out of there. And then, and then find friends who would do it for them. You know, he was always learning. And he wanted Brother Tillman and the others to critique his suit. He wanted them to look at it and say, well, you know, fix it up a little bit there, do a little bit there. So, and that was part of the tradition. The chiefs would come by the houses where the, you know, the families were working on them and would give them advice.
And also the great, do you use turkey feathers or do you ever use ostrich plumes? I mean, all this stuff, it's fascinating.
He had some fine lines. He wasn't about to use plumes.
You know,
he always felt that, you know, that you use turkey feathers. That's what you used, and other feathers he would find. But he wanted it to be a bird that could fly.
Right. I thought that was just great. But, you know, when The House of Dance and Feathers came out from the Neighborhood Story Project, I spent an afternoon with Ronald Lewis in The House of Dance and Feathers. And one of the costume designers, Cosmo, came by. And they were sitting there. And Cosmo was, like, drawing and doing his stuff. And he was like, you know, this keeps me out of trouble. Makes me happy and it keeps me out of trouble. And just that sense of devotion. This is a devotional practice for them,
yes.
This work, all year long. And it costs a lot of money, too.
It does. And so when Robbie, when he was young, he said they would wait for the ragman to come by and try to beg or with a few pennies buy a dress that might have some beadwork on it. They would look for any kind of discarded earrings, anything they could use. And then over time, of course, you know, the prices would rise. But I think he and others begin to appreciate this as being a very fine art. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as opposed to some kind of cast off thing, this was the real deal. And that's what I believe caught him, too, was just the beauty. And most people just see this wonderful example of art and dance a couple times a year. But what I love was learning more about his life the other days of the year and what he did and what a leader he was.
So human being to human being, what did you take away from him most of all?
He was always curious. He still wanted to know anybody who might have techniques for sewing.
Mm-hmm.
And he really wanted to pass on this tradition to the children. He saw how beneficial it had been for him as a young fatherless boy who had brought him in contact with. I think he never forgot what it was like to be a poor young person. And right. he wanted to be the responsible adult in any way he could to help others.
Well, this is such an inspiring book. I loved him as I read it. You grow to love him more and more and admire him more and more. And that bond you made with him is so evident on every page. It's magical, really.
Quite honestly, at his funeral, I mean, we were close, and I really liked him and was proud that he called me a friend. Mm-hmm. But, you know, standing up to deliver his eulogy, it's just at that moment, that precise moment, you know, I just remember it so distinctly because the full weight of this loss hit me. You can imagine some things intellectually, but when they land on you with both feet emotionally, that was tough to get through. Maybe that's why I thought about him so much over the years and didn't realize until I read his notes that he was actually leading me in the direction of writing this book.
Well, you honored him with this book.
Thank you.
I really believe that. We've been talking with Al Kennedy, whose terrific new book is Chief of Chiefs, Robert Nathaniel Lee and the Mardi Gras Indians of New Orleans, 1915 to 2001. Thank you so much, Al.
Thank you.
And happy Mardi Gras.
The same to you. I'll see you out there.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life. George Saunders discusses his book, Lincoln in the Bardo, Tuesday, February 20th at 7 at the New Orleans Advocate. This is a ticketed event with a fee. Tickets available at Garden District Bookshop. Clayton Delery signs Out for Queer Blood, his book about the killing of Fernando Rios, Thursday, February 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Zachary Lazar discusses and signs Vengeance, along with a performance by The Graduates, a group of women who were once members of the drama club at St. Gabriel's Prison, February 22nd at 7 at Cafe Istanbul in New Orleans. Kendra Holly signs Keto Happy Hour, 50-plus low-carb craft cocktails to quench your thirst, Thursday, February 22nd at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Christopher Shipman and Brad Evans read from and sign their long collaborative poem, Keats is Not the Problem, Thursday, February 22nd at 7 at the Dogfish Reading Series, 2448 North Villery in New Orleans. The 2018 Writers and Readers Symposium will be held at Hemingbow in St. Francisville on February 17th. Participants will hear noted authors Catherine Savage Brosman, John Kemp, Michael H. Rubin, Gennaro Keeley Smith, and Emma Walsh. Registration is from 8:30 to 9 a.m. Saturday, February 17th at the Hemingbow Convention Center in St. Francisville, Louisiana. The coordinator for these events is Missy Kuick at Conundrum Books, 504-427-0421. Tickets for both events are available at 2018writersandreaders.brownpapertickets.com. Thomas Bonner and Judith Bonner discuss and sign the new edition of Sherwood Anderson and Other Famous Creoles, February 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Friends of the Terrebonne Parish Public Library will hold their 15th annual Jambalaya Writers Conference March 3rd at the Main Library in Houma. Featured guests this year are horror writer R.L. Stine, Jocelyn Jackson, Melissa Marr, Louisiana poet laureate Jack Bedell, David Middleton, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, Katie Simpson Smith, Lady Hubbard, Bill Lofelm, Liz Talley, and many others. For ticket info and registration, go to mytpl.org to register. For more information about these events, check our website, wwno.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.